From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So The Media Project is underway once again, an opportunity for a half hour of commentary, analysis, and sometimes we even get some insight into the media issues of the week. And that's why we're here, because we keep trying until we get it right. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, and I am here today, of course, with Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio. How'd you do, Alan?
I'm fine. I just want everybody out there to know that you have a shirt on that has so much starch in it, it looks like it's going to get up and walk away.
Well, we have somebody from corporate visiting today, and I try to look my best, you know, to do what I can.
Oh, corporate.
The folks from the Hearst Tower down in New York, it's a wonderful thing. Here with Kaylin Brown, head of the journalism program at the College of St. Rose, professor.
Hello, and the communications department.
And the communications department. Yeah, I have to say, department, and I mean, these things are important in academia, department or program or...
Right. Kind of, and there are levels of professorships to full professor. I'm an associate professor. There's assistant professor.
All that.
Am I killing you, Rex?
No, but when you come up for promotion, I want to write a letter in your support because I'm a huge admirer.
Thank you, Alan.
Huge, I say. He's huge. And joined today by Barbara Lombardo, who, speaking of professor, you're teaching now at UAlbany, aren't you?
I've been teaching for 10 years at UAlbany.
For 10 years.
So I will be continuing. Last I knew, I was continuing to be teaching at UAlbany.
Right on top of this.
In the journalism department.
Good.
And what course do you teach?
Reporting and news writing. One and two.
Barbara is, of course, for many years, was managing editor of the Saratogian, was then executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. So what's the title of your blog? What do you call that?
Done with Deadlines.
Done with Deadlines. Yeah, because you can blog whenever you want to.
It's nice.
So you did an interesting thing on your blog the other day. You wrote about this notion of Jim Acosta, who is, of course, very unpopular with President Trump because he's been a persistent questioner. Asks questions that President Trump doesn't like. And you're suggesting that we should maybe get an I'm Jim Acosta t-shirt. Why is that?
Well, I don't think I actually referred to the t-shirt. But not that that's a bad idea. But what I think is that the Washington Press Corps needs to band together somehow and be of like mind in behalf of credible journalism. And as a group, I understand they're all competing with each other for the news, but I think as a group, they need to be willing to defend their profession. We shouldn't even have to defend our profession, but speak up, where if somebody doesn't get to ask the question that they need to ask, the next person asks that same question or asks the follow-up questions. Somebody asks the question, they get the staged answer, which begs for a follow-up question that they don't get to ask, the next reporter needs to ask that question. And I kind of felt bad that as a John Roberts had the opportunity, he had the next question after Jim Acosta was shot down, and he had that moment to make history, I think,
right,
to speak up right at that press conference. And although he did speak up later, I saw him on Fox News say, you know, my colleagues are credible, they have integrity, which was better than nothing.
I'm sorry, Rex, but you know, as we speak, as we're recording this, there was a reporter on who had, at the end of a very limited press conference the president had before he kicked everybody out of the room, asked a very tough question. And then they had her on CNN or Morning Joe this morning. And when she was pursuing Sarah Sanders at the briefing, Sarah Sanders tried to get out of talking to her and said, well, I'm going to call on so-and-so Jordan or whatever.
Yeah, that's what happened. That's NBC's Hallie Jackson was asking
that's
a tough
right.
question.
Hallie Jackson, yes.
And when Sarah Sanders went on to Jordan Fabian of The Hill, instead of asking his own question, he deferred back and said, I'll let Hallie have the question. And so I think that's exactly what you're talking about.
Sanders didn't really address that question.
Didn't really answer
the
question.
So he tried. So I think we have to keep trying over and over again and not get shot down.
But I loved your allusion to Spartacus. What was that?
Yes. Yeah, so if you haven't seen that Kirk Douglas movie, I certainly recommend it. And there's this one scene where he's one of the slaves, and the representative of the Roman government says, got news, good news for all of you slaves. We're not going to crucify you. You're going to continue to be slaves. We're not going to crucify you. All you have to do is turn over that one guy, Spartacus. And Kirk Douglas is about to step forward to turn himself in to save the others. And instead, his pal steps forward and says, I'm Spartacus. Mm-hmm. And then another person is motivated and says, I'm Spartacus. And all the slaves are speaking up, I'm Spartacus. So they're united in their front. And the
it's sort of like the more contemporary movie In and Out, where all the kids at graduation start to stand up and say, I'm gay, because their gay teacher was being
Right, same abused. Idea. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't end well for Spartacus at the end of that film.
But Barbara, you said something that was sort of interesting to me, piqued my interest, and that is that the person from Fox should have done differently than they did. And the next day said, well, my colleagues have integrity, whatever.
He actually said it that same day.
Not when he should have at that moment.
Not at that
right.
moment.
Right. And, and I wished he'd had done it then. It makes you wonder if you're on the spot, you're on television, you're representing your company. Did he just not have the wherewithal to do it, the presence of mind at that moment to say, this is what I should do? Because routinely that has happened where reporters are shot down and belittled and the next guy doesn't normally step in.
But also you make a good point. Is it the expectation of the pro-Trump network that you get him off the hook?
Depends. I'd say overall, Fox Network is going to let him off the hook. But it was Neil Cavuto was the Fox anchor who called it disgusting.
It happened, but everybody got back into line very quickly. Okay. Fox, of course, given all the talking points for the Trump partisans, now has moved along from the concerns about the Russian summit, it seems, and no one is talking about it anymore. And that, of course, gives cover to those who, well, I shouldn't put it that way, I guess. It is just their perspective, their what I would say is a significantly biased perspective by Fox News.
I think that's incontrovertible. I think Fox News's perspective is absolutely biased.
And because they have a certain viewership, they are the number one news source for most Republicans in the country. It's a self-reinforcing cycle. A new poll shows that 79% of Republicans, people who self-identify as Republicans, believe the president did well in Russia, which is significantly at odds with the rest of the people in the country.
And with reality.
<Now Touché. Barbara. laughs> But what about the rather striking response of TV anchors after the Trump-Putin appearance? I mean, there was a lack of
restraint.
That's a good way to put it. We didn't have the Cronkitean remove that we're accustomed to, the coolness.
On the contrary, I think because Cronkite had coolness, there were also what I would call Cronkite moments, which are, the end of the Vietnam War because Cronkite expressed disapproval with the war, or sometimes he was even wrong when Mario Cuomo was giving his speech and he said, there's the next candidate for president on the Democratic side, which didn't, of course, happen.
The incredulity of the anchors, though, after the Putin-Trump summit was justified, I thought, because it was an extraordinary moment in history. And it was extremely difficult for them to sit back and behave like typical. The word is not objective because I don't believe in that word when it comes to journalism, but fair and balanced response to the interaction between Trump and Putin. I think that the journalists had to signify that this is an extreme deviation from the norm, and that's why we had Anderson Cooper so upset and talking about it as disgraceful. He may have stepped out of the boundaries of typical journalism, but I think it was justified in that instance.
Well, I watched that Anderson Cooper, and I understand why he said what he did and why he was so moved to say it. But I think that it's an example of how CNN's credibility is injured when he's editorializing. So using, I forget what the words were, that he was disgraceful.
He said, you've been watching one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president at a summit in front of a Russian leader that I've ever seen.
Right. He said what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. I actually was what I was yelling at the television. But for him as a CNN anchor, I think he needed to find other words to say what happened.
Mm. But he's not alone. Nora O'Donnell on CBS News said they were almost chummy, as if they were allies. And well, George,
that's an observation.
Yeah.
That's using your eyes to report.
Aha, uh-huh. There you go. David Gergen, of course, who's hired to be a commentator, not to be an anchor, said, "I've never heard an American president talk that way."
And who worked for a lot of American presidents.
He did,
and
indeed.
He's a commentator.
Yeah, that's right. That's different. And though I don't know that American consumers of news really make the distinction. I think that they see Sean Hannity and they see Anderson Cooper as being the same kind of thing on their respective networks. And I think that's to your point, that when an anchor, a supposed neutral observer of things, steps outside the boundaries and does something like that, it reinforces that notion that, well, we're all just biased observers of what's going on.
Mm.
You know, Sean Hannity is, of course, a pal of the president. And he begins his interview with the president after the Putin performance by saying, "You were very strong at the end there."
But you know, this is the Media Project, and we discuss things that not everybody looks at. One of the things I'm fascinated by is the competition between MSNBC and CNN for liberal viewership. And I am not surprised that that competition may roll over into some of the remarks of the anchors on either place who are looking for that audience.
I agree with you, Alan.
Darn.
The day is young. I used to think that MSNBC versus Fox, and that CNN would be the middle of the road place where you could turn to, kind of like how there was that study that said Associated Press was the most believable as a source. And I had felt that way about CNN, and I do think they do a lot of objective, fantastic, in-depth reporting. But they've crossed that line, so they are, to me, the alternative to MSNBC, which I normally would listen to Morning Joe, but I was listening to you on my way in this morning.
What'd you think?
Did you like me? He said, "Yes, absolutely." You know, the great reporter Michael Isikoff has a warning that's really appropriate here. Isikoff is now, I think he's called chief investigative reporter for Yahoo News. But Isikoff was the guy whose coverage of the early Bill Clinton scandals was ignored by Newsweek. And he subsequently has done a lot of good reporting. Coincidentally, when I was a flack on the other side of things, he was one of the reporters covering me in Washington. Isn't that cool? When he was 22 years old. Anyway, Michael Isikoff, who has written the book Russian Roulette with the Mother Jones D.C. bureau chief, says that it is unprecedented to have a situation where a U.S. president is meeting in a summit with a Russian president while under investigation for his ties to the Russian president. But he really cautions against too much speculation in the Trump-Putin story, that we really need to just go with the facts at hand and not imagine what might be said in the closed door, or might imagine what kind of ties are there.
Or, Rexy, one might ask the question I continually ask, and Isikoff, I'm sure, would be not happy with it. What in hell does Putin have on Trump that would make him behave in the way that he's... Now, that's speculation.
Yeah.
But, it's cause and effect, and you say, well, you know, why is he... Basically, is the right word, bending over? What exactly is happening here? And why is this terrible thing going on? And then you ask a question that leads from that. But Isikoff might be angry with me for saying that. And so might you, Barbara.
I am not angry with you for saying that. It's impossible not to speculate, but I think there's over-speculation. And I'm kind of tired of hearing us in the media talk over and over again about things that we just don't yet know the answer to.
But do you think
I'm trying to patiently wait for Robert Mueller to...
But do you think what I just said about what has he got on him, do you think that's over speculation?
I think we don't know the answer to that.
I think that was the general response, though, from the public. I did see some political cartooning on that subject, that, you know, the average American's in front of the television, just a person watching television, and they see the results of that. And the two people watching the television look at each other and say, "What has he got on him?" I mean, that would be speculation on the part of a journalist. A political cartoonist is considered a journalist. So there is speculation. I think that journalism should refrain from speculation. I agree with Isikoff on that.
So you think I would be wrong in raising that issue?
I think it's important to raise issues, but I think that what needs to happen is the journalism needs to take place. So Isikoff, for instance, was talking on NPR today about the fact that he had included in his book Russian Roulette a lot of information about this Maria Butina, who's just coming out this week, but it was back months ago that his book was released, and he, Isikoff, had her on his radar, included information in his book about that. So that's the hard work of investigative journalism that Rex was talking about when he said, you know, Isikoff has done the work.
I think you guys might be talking about the same thing, coming at it from different ways. We have to speculate because we're trying to find out the answer to the why. That's part of being a journalist. Why is this happening?
So we have a little mail we need to talk about. Steve in Glenville says, regarding last week's show, remember we talked about the Thailand story, the kids in the cave?
Sure.
He says, yes, Ira Fussfeld was right. The Thailand story was overcovered, but at the same time, undercovered. I don't know what that means. But I never heard what they were doing in the cave anyway. To Alan's point, yes, of course there's going to be a movie made, If a Kid Falls Down a Well, starring a local boy makes good Kirk Douglas. Remember Ace in the Hole? Something kind of like that. It was a great noir movie. And to Rex's observation about sending reporters to knock on the door of the family of a victim, now here's what I want to get at. Steve in Glenville says, this has always struck me as absurd, that is a reporter going to knock on the door when there's been a tragedy. And one of the reasons people don't like reporters, I'd really love for the family member, especially if there are cameras rolling, to say, how the bleep do you think I feel? You know, my point is that I understand that that seems intrusive to a family, but I think that the result, the story about the human reaction to tragedy, helps us all to be more human. I think we need to have the empathy that great journalism dwelling on that topic can produce. So it's actually an important part of what we do. We need to give people a sense of how families, for example, cope with tragedy. It is not an inappropriate question, frankly. You hope that you phrase it a little bit more gently, but to try to find out how people feel when they are the subject of news is, I think, an important part of the job.
Well, you know, Rexy, that if you are so stupid to walk up and say, how do you feel about your kid being killed?
Right.
That's absurd. But, you know, I see parents all the time who are only too willing to talk about violence in a neighborhood, for example, who have lost a child, and guns and things of that kind. So you'd be right that the story should be covered, that the parents are important people to talk to, but not absurdly.
So in my classroom a few years ago, Freeman Klopit, who at the time was a reporter for Bloomberg News, came to speak to my class. He was scheduled to come to speak to my class prior to Newtown happening. But when there was the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, Freeman was deployed to go and cover that. And he had to go to the home of a family whose child had been at the school when the shooting occurred. And Freeman, in a most sensitive way, talked about what he experienced when he went up to a family and talked to a mother and eventually the child. They agreed that they would talk to Freeman. My class was captivated. It was heartbreaking to hear about it, but no one was better prepared to do that than this reporter. He was so sensitive. You could tell it had rattled him, but the story that he was able to tell as a result of this young child who had experienced this was valuable for people to understand the gravity of what happened.
So that is the job of the journalist, is to expand people's horizon, to give people a true view of what lies beyond their own experience. And so I think that's really an important part of it.
And remembering that there are good journalists and bad journalists.
Right. And inexperienced journalists, too.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And I think that's great that that happened in the classroom. And I think that's a lesson that will stick with those students for the rest of their lives. And in our classrooms and in our newsrooms, I think sometimes we send young reporters out who may don't know how to ask those questions, and maybe we need to do more training on that end of how to ask, not how do you feel,
right?
But to talk to them about how to ask those kinds of questions.
Very good point. Well, I don't know, it's hard to train people how to interact as human beings with each other, but since we're all looking at our devices, speaking of which, our data, what is it that NBC News calls it? Data download is what they have on Meet the Press. But here we have our own little element of it. We like to keep you up to date, folks, on what's going on. The Pew Research Center.
Phew.
This is the sound effect that we always get when we say that. Yeah, it's just that's why I hesitate. Very good. You know, 96% of Americans access news via the internet. So this is how the world is so different from what it used to be. But it is now true. More U.S. adults get news on mobile devices than on a desktop or a laptop. So that is one of the changes that just over the past few years has really come into play. I remember when only about a third of people who had mobile devices said, I use it for news. And now we're saying 58% of Americans get news via their mobile devices.
And well, in the middle of the night, when I wake up a couple times and I check the news, I'm not about to turn the television on with my wife, you know, sleeping next to me and doing all of that. But I keep wondering on an ancillary subject is, what about those headline writers in the New York Times or the people who are putting out next day's paper? Rex, you maybe give us some insight onto this, because you know by the next day, the lead story in the New York Times ain't going to be what it has on the front page of the Times.
Yeah, we cater to mobile entirely these days, and we need to do it better.
How so?
Well, we need to make sure that we aren't presenting any content that doesn't have a visual component to it, because you have to have visual for people to pay attention to stuff on mobile. And that's been a hard lesson for us in print, those of us who have worked in newspapers, to learn you can't get by with just words.
Well, you know, you were talking about the Russian spy, Maria
Butina.
Butina. She rose to the top of the chart as we speak this morning because there was an allegation that she was going to trade sexual favors for access. Come on, you'd have to be completely insensitive to know what those editors are thinking now that this becomes something that most people are interested in.
Well, you don't have to have an editor's thinking, actually, on that. You have all the data that
sure
propels a thing forward. So that if a story begins to develop a following, you can track in real time exactly how many people are looking at the story and to see what's trending, how long it's been rising high. We have a big monitor in the newsroom right now that shows everybody exactly how stories are moving, how many people are looking at a story at that given moment, and how long it's been one
really
of our top stories.
Really? So you'll know how many people are looking at CNN or MSNBC or Fox?
No, how many people? Well, we could do that if we wanted to.
Yeah.
We would know how many people are looking at our stories. I'm specifically talking about TimesUnion.com and from which platform, whether they're looking at it on mobile or through social. And so that's actually very useful, but it's, of course, not the same as print.
Well, I think that editors need to be thinking about how that affects the way people are reading and how we present our news. So you're saying having visuals, but I think we also should be getting away, I've thought this for years, from the long narrative pieces when you want points of entry in a story where the bullet points, Q&As, so that readers don't have to slog through a story on their phone.
A friend of mine was the editor of Consumer Reports, and he said they called it chunkification. We have to do the chunkification of our stories.
I'm still a fan of also encouraging readers to actually read from beginning to end a story, because we need an intellectually challenged and educated citizenry so that we can have educated humans who are voting, especially in case they're interested in voting in the upcoming midterms.
Barbara, one of the things we fight about here all the time is the pomposity of...
Thank you, Alan. Okay, we're out of time, and therefore it's time for us to go.
Doing what's right versus doing what's easy.
Well, maybe I'll get asked back. We could talk more
about that.
our happy listener, Jim in Frankfort, Michigan, says, I've been listening to the Media Project for a couple of years now, ever since Stephen Metcalf gave you a nice recommendation on Slate's Culture Gab Fest. He says, I really enjoy the show. My only complaint is the show always seems to end too early.
You should do an hour, and then everybody should know it's all your fault, Rex, because we've asked you to do an hour many, many times, and you're always the one who says nothing doing.
Off.
I'm too important.
I have to cut this guy off. The Media Project, Kaylin Brown, Barbara Lombardo, Alan Chartok, I'm Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people, like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized...
The Media Project is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Alan Chartok is CEO of WAMC, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York, commentator, columnist, and author. Rex Smith is editor of the Times Union. Kaylin Brown is chair of the Department of Communication at the College of St. Rose. And Barbara Lombardo is a journalism professor at the University at Albany and former executive editor of the Saratogian and Troy Record. You can listen to or podcast The Media Project anytime at WAMC.org or just download the WAMC app for your iPhone or Android at the Play Store today. Thanks for listening.
Acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.